Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month med plus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Billy, thank you so much for joining me today on Misunderstood. It's really great to have you here. When I created this platform of people who had been reduced to a headline and they were on a mission to change their narrative, before I even started, you were on my shortlist because I have followed your story for a long time. I found you fascinating and I wanted to hear your story from you because it's been that fascinating and everybody has a ton of questions. So anyways, thank you for joining us 3 years after my original invite, but thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. off probation now, so a little bit more free to talk. And so excited to finally be here. And I got to deliver, I guess, 3 years to practice.
Right. That's great. So listen, you're one of the most talked about founders of the last decade, maybe for some of the wrong reasons. And I really want to give you a chance to like talk about that and walk us through what happened in your words, right? But before that, I was saying to you earlier, I really think it's important to understand you. I've watched a lot of interviews with you, but I don't really know where you came from. I don't know how you got into this because whether or not people are like you, hate you, trust you, don't, you are a very interesting entrepreneur. You get it. You are fast. You're a hustler. And that just doesn't come naturally. You learn that or you're kind of born into that. So where are you from? What was your childhood like? What did you want to be growing up?
I hope we get more exciting because I have the most boring answer. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City in New Jersey in a very regular family. I think the blessing and the curse of when I was growing up was that I got high-speed internet in my house in fifth grade, and I received a computer that year for Christmas. And that was the beginning of the end or the beginning of the beginning, however you want to frame it. I quickly fell in love with computers, taught myself how to program, and really used that early Wild West days of the internet as this vehicle to explore as a young preteen and try to find my own way in the world without a system and where rules really hadn't yet been established.
Right. Did you ever actually hold down a 9-to-5 job?
No, never had a 9-to-5 job. I had 3 full-time employees when I was 13, and I got busted because one of them sent an invitation to his wedding to my parents' house. And they're like, why the hell is this grown man inviting me to a wedding? Like, what's going on?
Oh my gosh. Wait, so what did you do at 13? What was your business?
I had a web hosting business, and this is like pre-Amazon AWS, and I helped small businesses get their websites online, and they paid me like a monthly fee to operate their websites.
How much were you making?
Not that much, but it was great for like a 13-year-old and enough to pay 3 people, but you know, can't afford my Manhattan rent. So
wow, amazing. Okay, so did you go to college?
I went to college. I went to a small school in Pennsylvania called Bucknell. I was supposed to study computer science. I ended up starting my first like venture-backed tech startup during my freshman year, raised money for that, and dropped out of school and never went back.
Wow. All right. So can you tell us a little bit of like what you did once you dropped out of school? What were your big ideas? What did you want to do? What were you good at?
So the story went back to my later years in middle school and high school. Mm-hmm. I started a social networking site for my middle school. This is like in the early Facebook days. Mm-hmm. So it is a private network for all my middle school kids. And I love this feeling where I wake up and go to school in the morning, and a good percentage of my like friends, they're all using my website every single night. So it helped me like break the ice with girls. It helped me get more friends. It was kind of like this weird experience where I'd go home, do something like super nerdy, and then it actually impacted my day-to-day life.
Right.
I sold a couple more like small ones throughout middle school and high school.
When you say sell, like, were you making actually a lot of money and selling it to like a big company, or you were just kind of handing it off for a couple bucks?
The first one started small for, you know, a couple $1,000. And then in high school, I started a real one that I sold to a company called Buddy TV out of Seattle. And that was pretty sizable for like a 15 or 16 year old. I went to college, like literally with a suitcase of cash. I never really had, you know, much experience like money or resources as a kid. Lived with my family, like really normal, like suburban lifestyle. And went to college as an 18-year-old, you know, bought a car, went to nightclubs, or like traveling around the world and realizing like what I could do with a couple bucks in my pocket.
Yeah.
Blew it all in the first semester and was like, fuck, I need that back. And like, how can I get that feeling back? And that was to get back to programming.
Yeah.
So I started what I thought would be another social network during my first year of college and raised money to go out and attempt to build another social network.
So how old are you now?
I'm 34 now.
Oh, you're 34. Okay. So I'm 51. And when I grew up, I don't know if you know these people. Do you know Noah Tupperberg and Jason Strauss?
Yes.
Okay. So I went to Nightingale. They went to St. David's, I guess, and then ended up going to Riverdale and blah, blah, blah. And they were like ahead of the time back then too, because at 15 and 16, they were helping doing promoting at these nightclubs and making, Jason and I were each other's first kiss when we were 13. And I remember being in his bedroom and he had this metal box and it was filled with cash, and there's cash like coming out of the sides of the metal box. And then he had to get another one. And it was fascinating, but you know, fast forward, Noah and Jason created a monster, and now they teach at Harvard about creating a brand. And they, for people that are listening, they ended up starting Marquee. And then we went to Vegas and we did Tao, and they have like over 40 brands now. And it started as a kid. So it's like not unheard of that people really can figure out what they want to do as a kid and understand that customer service becomes a huge part of the best part of a business and keeps you in business, because those relationships end up being the thing that gets you further than sometimes college.
Yeah, totally agree. I think the like a tendency to explore or like resourcefulness, I think that often appears when you're younger.
Yeah.
And how you channel that, both good or bad, obviously is told as you grow up.
Right. So the first thing that I think got you a lot of press was, or at least from what I've seen, is you created this like black card or this card for people to be social with, right?
Correct. So I started a black card for young people, initially in New York City, called Magnesis. The background was I moved to New York. I was 18. I had a venture-backed business. I raised venture capital for my social network company in college. And I started to meet people from all these different industries that I just didn't really know existed, coming from the New Jersey suburbs. I'd be meeting like record labels or TV networks or music artists. And there's this whole big world out there. I kept calling my friends who are now sophomores in college, trying to explain to them like what was happening in New York, and no one really believed me. Mm-hmm. So I started this black card as a way to give access or create these experiences around this life that I was starting to live or really starting to explore and see what was out there in the world.
Right. And I saw that it became something you started to get press for. You were on some TV networks or news stations about it. So it really took off and people found this to be like something that was worthy of money and of access, right?
I think these are like the pre-member club days. There was Soho House, and that was kind of like the only membership option. It was certainly at that time, at least a higher level of clientele than I was targeting. I was 19 years old. So I was targeting the younger 20s, people who were in their first or second years and maybe a good job, but weren't quite there yet on the income scale or like really established yet in life. So it was kind of this really interesting like millennial membership club. We had almost 30,000 members paying us an annual fee. So it was like a really good business, and it was a fun business, because every time I would meet somebody new or go and explore a new location through my more tech-esque company, I would then try to open that up and offer it to my peers. And so it was like a really kind of fun way to explore my early, like late teens and early 20s.
Right. And it was a way of like buying cool almost, because these people who might not have had access to that stuff were all of a sudden getting invites to special parties or feeling like they were part of the in crowd.
Exactly. My target clientele was like the more corporate college graduate who's, you know, their second year into their job. They just moved to New York City from wherever they grew up. And this kind of gave them the ability to explore at an enhanced rate, maybe meet some interesting people. Tons of people got married through it. So
yeah.
Funny to see now people with like, you know, husbands, wives, kids, houses, all kind of met in the early Magnesis days. So that's pretty cool.
So, and I think the thought then is that you were way ahead of your time. You were a genius. You were this entrepreneur that was young, that you were opening doors for yourself and others. So how did that end up? Did you sell it? What happened with that?
One of my biggest regrets was not seeing Magnesis through. We had a couple of acquisition offers from companies that you've heard of. We didn't accept them for various reasons. Mm-hmm. It was a really good business, and I got distracted by the allure and the glitz and I think what the real potential was of FIRE. And after Fire failed, which I'm sure we'll get into, I sold Magnesis for pennies. So one of the biggest like commercial and personal regrets was once I had something that really worked, not seeing it through the finish line and just trying to sprint and move so quickly and not understanding what I had was great. And I didn't need to skip to the next at that point in my life.
Right. So, you know, I was watching the documentary the other day. How did you come up with the name Fire?
It was a totally made up word. Magnesis was a made up word as well. I think we kind of like reverse engineered it later to say that Fire stood for your real entertainment, but that was kind of BS. So we were just like taking the word Fire as cool, right? Changing the I to a Y and trying to find a one or two syllable short word that we could use.
Cool. And what I think a lot of people don't understand, because so many of us have just seen the aftermath, I thought Fire was a festival. I thought this was an event business that was a festival business, but it wasn't. That was the aftermath, or the almost like the marketing to an actual tech company, right?
The festival itself was like an impulsive marketing idea. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of ironic that that's what it's known for now. Fire was started because I was booking a lot of music artists for these concerts for my Magnesis cardholders. We did 40 or 50 concerts in New York. We'd book mid-level hip hop artists mostly to come and perform. And I just realized through that process, like how difficult and how backwards that process was.
Right.
I had a young business. I had some revenue. I had some budget. And it was so difficult to get in touch with the artists or the managers or the agents. And there was this whole world of smoke and mirrors and a lot of like BS, a lot of extra middlemen. So I wanted to create a tech platform where guys like me could get in touch directly with an artist for a sponsorship, an appearance, a performance, whatever it may be. So Fire was made as a tech platform, and the festival kind of became this unexpected behemoth of like a marketing aspect that we didn't anticipate in the beginning.
Got it. So for that tech platform, I mean, I found that kind of fascinating because nowadays you have, what's the one where you can, oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking on the name, the Cameo, like where you can reach people directly. There's a couple versions of that, but also, you know, listen, I've been married. I've wanted to access different people to hire them for occasions. And you do have to go through different platforms. You got to find the manager. Sometimes they're asking crazy money, you know? So how did it work as a platform? Did you actually just become friends with some of these stars and work that way? Like, how'd you even do that? Cause that's a great idea, by the way.
So I'd built the relationship with a few dozen of the artists because I'd booked them for Magnesis.
Got it.
I just kind of got in the habit of once I met them, asking them like why it was so difficult. I'm like, why did Jim have to call John, who had to call Jerry, who called Patrick? And what I started learning is the amount that I was paying was not actually communicated to the artist.
Sure.
So let's say I paid $10,000. The artist might've gotten $4,000 because he had three or four different middlemen either, you know, lying or taking advantage. So the pitch to the artist was that you can actually see what your real offers are and you can wake up in the morning and just click yes or click no. So it was found revenue for the talent on the platform, and there was no disadvantage for them being on there. So that was the pitch, is like giving them transparency and the ability to say yes or no themselves to whatever offers are coming in for them.
Do you think if you had stuck with that platform and forget the festival part of the marketing, that you could have really built that slowly, but like created a whole market for that?
I think there was definitely a good market for the platform. I was just in this phase where I was living literally by the hour and just trying to sprint and go so quickly. I just didn't have the patience or the wherewithal to really understand how long things should take and how to go through that proper process.
Right. Which now sounds like a little bit of a pattern because you are skipping through the Magnesis stuff as well and wanted to move to the next thing. It sounds like you get excited by projects and the possibilities of them without seeing it through, like you just said, kind of.
I think the projects would lead me to a new door that I didn't know existed. I would open the door and then I'd see an even bigger door, right? Because like, I think all this action just goes to show you like what else is possible in the world. So I kept trying to open and sprint into larger and larger doors without completing the mission in each one of the rooms along the way.
Right. Okay. So now here we are in the conversation to the part where you guys are sitting in a meeting for Fire for the technology, you know, the platform. And you're like, wait, this is a great idea. We should create a festival. Like, were you having problems with the revenue that you were like, wait, this will make us a lot of money? Like, how did the idea come about?
So totally separate from Fire, I had fallen in love with like the islands and ocean sports at a young age. Mm-hmm. I've been running small trips for a Magnesis customers to the Exuma chain of the Bahamas for years. Okay. We would take three or four like really small propeller planes that probably shouldn't be able to make it that far, fly from New York to the Bahamas, spend these long weekends in the islands, like We'd like cook for ourselves, we'd make campfires, we'd go spearfishing. There's like these really fun ways just to get out of the corporate like world of New York and take people to a place they probably wouldn't go without us. And those trips are great for a number of years. And as Fire was starting, and as we're starting to pitch larger artists to join the platform, my like unique advantage were these little islands that I had rented in the Bahamas. So I started taking the artists to these islands more for sales trips rather than anything else. And during one of the trips, I brought an old high school friend and he said, you should totally do a music festival here for all your Magnesis members. So that was the beginning of the end.
That was the beginning of the end. Okay. And how did you become partners with Ja Rule? That always shocked me as well. It's sort of random.
So Ja Rule was one of the artists that I had booked a number of times through Magnesis to do concerts for our members. We had the conversations about the transparency, and it got to one time where it was like so difficult to get him booked for a show. And when he was finally booked, I just asked him, we were on a helicopter actually to our concert in the Hamptons that we booked for Magnesis. I'm like, why the fuck didn't you respond to me for 2 weeks? He goes, I was just called this morning with the offer. Like Wow. That's when it finally clicked that this made no sense, right? Here's an artist who wants the show and wants the revenue. Here's a customer who has a seemingly attractive opportunity. Why isn't there a better way to connect these two sides? So we slowly started working on Fire together as a way to fix that problem.
Got it. So now we've all seen the documentary, or you haven't, I guess, right?
No, I've never watched it.
So they do a really good job of giving you the visuals on this original, what I call the original Fire Festival. You have all these models, you have Ja Rule, you have a bunch of people there with you doing a photo shoot, which looks like an amazing fucking trip. Okay. It looks like that's what this should have been.
The best.
Yeah. The best of the best. Probably was a great time. But leading up to that, like all of a sudden was Ja Rule like, okay, I want to be your partner in this and this is what we're going to do? Or was it like fly by the seat of your pants? Like, this seems fun. Like, it's hard, you know, to be in the events business is one whole separate thing from being in the music business, from being, you know, these are all different skills you have to come together. So how did that come about that you started to put this together to get to that place where it was good, right? Where you had all the people there. That's fascinating in itself that you got those people all there.
Yeah, so great question. So we started it a little bit more, I guess, intellectually, but we started Fire together as a company prior to the festival existing. Mm-hmm. We were equal partners on Fire. And when we spun up the idea for the festival, it was just operating under like the regular Fire company. So nothing had really changed at that point. We'd worked together for however long it took to build the Fire app and start that business together. And I think momentum is really contagious, right? And people who are very successful are the best at using momentum to create additional momentum. Mm-hmm. And that was happening to us initially at a small scale. And then obviously it went big very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think together we were just really great at playing off each other's strengths and creating this excitement and this momentum that we were dragging in, whether it was great talent, whether it was investors, whether it was brands. And we kind of created this small snowball effect where it was getting really big really quickly.
How did you book those models?
I think the whole concept went from zero to 100 very fast. I've been doing these trips for years. The initial trips were not talent focused. They were more customer focused for, you know, young people like me who thought it was like this great escape. Mm. And I remember sitting in our office one day and one of my investors introduced me to the president of IMG, who at the time I think was the premier modeling agency. And I called him and said, hey, we had an idea last weekend to do a festival on this little island. I've been going here for 5 or 6 years. It's great. Like, I want these like 10 models to come. And he literally like laughed me off the phone and like basically said, I took the call to appease your investor, but get lost, kid. So we kind of like worked her way down the list until we hired like a decent talent group, went to the island, and we had this incredible 3 or 4 day weekend where everybody came back to New York and said, like, that was the best weekend of my life.
Right.
And that same guy called me back and said, my entire roster wants to come. Like, what do we do next? So
wow. It
was kind of this like full circle moment where, you know, anything can happen if the momentum there is strong enough.
Right. So do you mean then you went a second time with those top tier models?
We were basically probably did 10 or 11 different like promotional trips.
Oh.
I think one or two were covered at the end of the day, but it was a slow process of being told to get lost to delivering a really good experience for a small group. And then the stories, the tales of what happened on these exotic islands started to grow, right? And then that attracted the larger talent.
Got it. Because they did skip through that then, because they made it seem like you had one trip and you had everyone from Hailey Bieber to, you know, whoever it was. And normally these are people who nowadays are, you know, would charge hundreds of thousands of dollars to be in one place and get photographed and blah, blah, blah.
One of the biggest like things I talk to new entrepreneurs about all the time is like there's this idea where I woke up one day, made a bad spreadsheet, and then raised $30 million like with no background. And I think my biggest advice to these people is like my worst crime was actually violating the trust, because the investors, the talent, whatever they were, they had backed me or been working with me for a long period of time before this happened. Mm-hmm. So I think Netflix tries to make, or not Netflix, the documentary tried to make this story where I woke up one day and like went bad and then everything good happened because of that. Where in the reality was everything was years in the making, and to have a loss that big took dozens and dozens of small wins and small losses along the way to get to that point.
Well, that's a really, I love hearing you say that, because that's really important. I do think that you miss out on that. So you had created this credibility and this trust between a lot of people to be able to get you that much money from investors and for people to take a chance on you. So it wasn't just one day you were like, hey, I'm this kid and I got all these hot friends and these famous friends and we're just going to do this crazy thing. I mean, you up until this point where things started to kind of get out of hand for a series of reasons that we'll get into, you were doing right moves that created the next right move that was giving you that credibility, right? Would you say?
Correct. The actual crime was lying to investors to try to raise money. Mm-hmm. Most of the capital came from investors who had backed me for 5 or 6 years. So when I came to them and said, this has the most potential of anything I've tried so far, and here's why I'm excited about, they weren't in a position to really question what I was saying, because sure, they had seen the small wins, they had seen the failures, they knew the strengths, they knew the weaknesses, and they believed in me. So I think the worst like moral and ethical violation was that trust that I abused at the end. It wasn't this like wake up one day and the whole world gives you money because you take a good picture. So
right.
I hope all entrepreneurs can listen to that and understand it.
Yeah, totally.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. Forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
What if I told you that the idea that you only get parasites when you travel to some exotic country is flat wrong? Millions of Americans carry parasites right now, often without symptoms. For example, it's estimated that millions in the United States have been exposed to Toxocara, a parasitic worm, yet most never even know it. Parasites do not need a plane ticket. They can enter through tap water, sushi, undercooked foods, or contaminated produce. Some strains live in all stages, eggs, larvae, adults, hidden in your gut, releasing toxins that sabotage your energy and digestion. That's why I'm excited about Parify, Kim Rogers' 30-day full-spectrum parasite cleanse. The kit works by clearing parasites, worms, candida, and heavy metals, targeting parasites in all life stages, supporting gut health, detox pathways, and toxin removal. It's taken orally, daily for 30 days with precise dosing. I'm actually doing it myself right now. I started with the lymph cleanse, then I'm doing the Parify. Want to dive deep? I did a full interview with Kim Rogers, the worm queen herself, where we expose all the myths, understand the facts, and show how to protect your body. Listen to that episode if you haven't already. Meanwhile, go to rogershood.com and use the code Rachel to get 10% off of your order. That's R-A-C-H-E-L for 10% off. Give it a try. Maybe your body's missing link is hiding inside. Let's do this together. Again, it's rogershood.com, R-O-G-E-R-S-H-O-O-D.com, and use the code Rachel for 10% off. If you've ever been through a divorce or you're in one right now, you already know it's not just emotional, it's chaotic. It's paperwork, deadlines, financial disclosures, custody schedules, legal filings, and half the time you don't even know what you're supposed to be tracking until it's too late. That's why I want to tell you about Splitify. It's an AI-powered divorce operating system designed to turn divorce from drama into data while saving you time and money. Splitify helps you organize all of your documents, evidence, custody details, communication, finances, everything into one secure platform. It can even help flag high conflict behavior, track custody schedules, map assets and debts, and generate court-ready files so you're not walking into a legal battle completely unprepared. Whether you're working with an attorney, going through a mediation, or doing it on your own, Splitify helps you stay organized, informed, and strategic because divorce is expensive enough without wasting time and money on confusion. So if you want to protect yourself, protect your kids, and walk into this process with clarity and control, go to mysplitify.com. Use the code Rachel for 50% off your first 3 months. That's mysplitify, mysplitify.com, promo code Rachel. Well, what was fascinating to me though is, okay, so it seems like when you were finally arrested for something, it's like you were talking about for lying to investors about what the spreadsheets really were. But why did you get to the point that you had to do that? Because had you kept it small, like had you kept it a 40-person really intimate thing, you could have really pulled it off, don't you think?
There's just so many silly decisions where I look back now, almost 8 or 9 years later, and just don't really understand the thought process. I think it kind of came down to this condensed timeline. We were there. My friend said, let's do a music festival. I said, great idea. Let's do it in 4 months. And we kind of set this goal and we told the world this date. And I didn't have any appreciation or understanding of the logistics needed to literally build a city out of nowhere on an island or what it took to actually host thousands of people in a foreign country. So I just didn't really know what I was getting into. And I was so dead set on trying to live up to this date that I promised that I made unethical, bad, whatever you want to call it, decisions to try to satisfy this date that was created out of nowhere.
So the big question then is, why didn't you stop it and maybe say, listen, we have to be, due to whatever reasons, we need to do this next year?
Yes. In hindsight, very simple to look back and say we should have stopped it at numerous points. I think the reality was probably a little bit more nuanced, where the second we announced that we have this big festival in 4 months, every single day brought new challenges and new problems. And we kept finding ways and pulling tricks out of our sleeve to solve larger and larger problems every single day. We probably should have failed 4 months before the actual festival took place. But it was like this weird combination of random successes that gave us the confidence that we thought we can keep pushing through. Right. But in reality, we probably would have stopped ourselves had we not been able to solve these seemingly insurmountable issues earlier on in the process.
So the first couple issues was figuring out the island to use, right? Because I think you moved the island a couple times.
Yeah. So the probably the biggest miss on my part was we rented an island that's a decently well-known island in the Exumas. It was Pablo Escobar's former like henchman's island, I think is the best way to put it. And they made it clear to us that we couldn't say it was Pablo Escobar's island.
Right.
We launched a trailer with a lot of the talent that we've referenced that people know about and 30 seconds into the trail, they were like on Pablo Escobar's former island. So the day after the trailer comes out, you know, the island owner just like calls me. He's like, I'm going to sue you if you don't get the fuck off my island. So
no way. We
were quickly displaced from our home.
Okay. So quick question. If you had been able to keep it on that island, would that have changed the outcome?
It's so hard to say. We were probably screwed anyway. It's really difficult to like add up which problem actually took us over the edge.
Right.
I was in like a really bad plane situation this weekend, and we were stuck in fog over the mountains. And I thought that was going to be it. But like they teach you in pilot school that like one issue never crashes the plane. It's when like 6, 7, 8, 9 issues stack up, when they all kind of come together, that's what crashes the plane. So I think the similar thing happened with us. The island itself wasn't enough. The storm wasn't enough. The investor credibility wasn't enough, but it was a combination of a lot of mishaps that led to the large failure.
Right. How much of your own money were you putting in at this time?
I think I lost like in cash $2-ish million. Wow. In my personal money. I lost all the value of my equity though in most of my other businesses, because whatever they were valued at legitimately went, you know, pretty much to zero after fire crashed.
Right.
I think when
you mean
because
your credibility crashed with it is essentially
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think when it came time actually to get sentenced for my crime, the fact that I lost my own money really helped. If I had taken $10 million and went and bought a couple of houses, I think the outcome would have been far worse.
Right. So again, I want to talk about just two more things on that, because I found it fascinating. So you had this terrible luck with Mother Nature, one of the problems, the night before, and there's a rainstorm and everything goes to shit. Now, before this, you guys hadn't constructed great tents and options and blah, blah, blah. Do you think if that storm had not happened, could you have pulled off, you know, having people be okay with these like hurricane tents and like these random mattresses and the cheese plate or whatever it was that you saw on TikTok? Like, could people have gotten over that if it wasn't soaking wet?
That's a good question. I think like, if I look at it quickly, I'm like, if there was no storm, the festival would have proceeded. And then if I take a more like intellectual approach, it's like, the storm was one of 10 issues. And if there wasn't a storm, something else might have happened that I just can't guess right now that would have put it over the edge. I think in like the last moments, if there was no storm, it would have proceeded. But that's not to say something else wouldn't have popped up that I just couldn't have guessed, right? And took us over the edge. And like something as simple as we had one water line into the area where the festival was, where people were staying. And like one of my investor's sons was a 17-year-old intern. We gave him the keys to like our box truck and he ran over the water line, right? So like took the water out at the last second. Like that by itself wouldn't be enough to kill us, but who's not to say that something else wouldn't have happened given like the lack of resources on my side.
I hear you. So a part of the story is you have somebody that has known you for a long time. I think his name is Andy, right? Andy King, is that his name?
Yes.
Okay. He is in the documentary. I'm sure you've heard the story already, but he says that there was one part where kind of a day before whatever, you ran into an issue with somebody not releasing water for, you know, the whole island. And you basically say to him, listen, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to take one for the team. And I need you to basically suck this guy's dick. And he says this great story. And he's a very likable guy where he showers up, puts on cologne, goes down there and is literally ready to suck this guy's dick. And fortunately for him, for everybody, whatever, he doesn't have to. Did that story really happen?
So I learned about this story in jail. the documentaries came out when I was in prison, and this one prison guard who was always like a little sneaky just came up to me and he's like, McFarland, did you pay some guy to suck some custom official's dick for water? I'm like looking at him like, this guy's crazy. He's like, no, you can tell me, it's okay. Like, I'm just totally confused. I have no idea what this guy is talking about. I'm like, what are they claiming I did now? And then, you know, I think my family came to visit me like a day or two later and tell me what happened. So yeah, learned about that in jail. So that was a little wild.
So it didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. Okay. I spoke with him years later on a podcast and he's like, oh, someone called me and said, like Billy said, do whatever it takes. And I guess I'm not sure how that.
Yeah, he had elaborated in his mind based on what he probably wanted to do or whatever. Okay.
Maybe he wanted the different outcome. I don't know.
Right. Okay. All right. So in real time, because again, in the documentary, there's a lot of video happening and you see you standing on a table or something and you're just telling people to calm down or get a drink or whatever in real time. And then there's, you know, you're panicking, you're walking back and forth. Tell me about the day when you were there, and this, and they all start to get off the plane and it's day one and things are literally, they can't go any worse in real time. How did that feel?
I didn't know we were in trouble until I was standing on this milk carton. I know there's a picture that got circulated where I'm like, in like a 4 day old t-shirt trying to like calm the crowd down. And my head of operations came up to me with a phone call. I was like, Billy, you have to take this. And I'm speaking to a reporter from a, you know, fairly large tablet. And someone's live streaming me on the homepage of that tablet's website. And the reporter goes, we heard you ran away on your yacht with a bunch of models and cocaine. I didn't have a yacht. I didn't have any cocaine. And I respond back to the reporter saying, you guys are literally live streaming me right now talking to you, like in a sea of people right here. Yeah. And she said, I have two credible sources. I'm running the story. So it was like that moment where I realized that all the mistakes I had made were so bad and became so big that it was at the point where the truth no longer mattered. And the salacious aspect of the story was like so good that there was nothing that could have been done to save us at that point.
Right. So what did you do from that point on? How many days did you stay? How did people finally get off the island?
So just to kind of get back to the crazy issues we solved, one of the big issues was transportation.
Right.
We literally rented two 737 planes for like 2 weeks because we had the festival over 2 weekends. We opened up a fire terminal at Miami International Airport. Wow. We painted like one of the planes with like girls in bikinis and like our fire logo. It was pretty, you know, a 24-year-old, like, you know, boys like dream, right? So right. Kind of absurd to look back on. And we were running the planes back and forth all day long, bringing guests. The first 1,000 guests had arrived. We canceled the event shortly after I was on that milk carton. And I remember making the call to the airport, who then radioed the pilot, and they turned one of the planes back in the air that was already on the way from Miami with the guests. And that's kind of when all hell broke loose.
Right. So I assume then it's like phone calls and DMs and people that are upset want their money back, people trying to get home, and then the fallout of just everything. You know, how? So like, what are those moments like that day, that next day, the third day? Like, what are you doing? You're just going home and saying, oh my God, or what?
I think the weirdest thing finally occurred when one of my investors who I, you know, had highly respected and a politically involved person, very smart guy, he called me and basically said whatever money that him and his friends had invested, it was a handful of million dollars. He's like, I need that back right now or else you're going to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in handcuffs. And I never fathomed like what I had done was actually like a real federal crime. I knew it was wrong. But I was so driven by this idea that if I just make Fyre Festival happen, all the investors will be happy, whether that's making money, whether that's the social currency they get for backing this business that was doing something.
Yeah.
I just felt like I had to make this happen and everybody would then like me and be okay with it. And once I got that phone call from a guy I really loved and like respected, and it just became like so black and white, like I need this back or else this is going to happen. And all the like the bank accounts, the credit card accounts, they were all frozen, you know, within hours of the festival being canceled. So it's a really weird time where I finally realized that I was in trouble.
So explain that to me, because I think a lot of people would wonder, how much did you actually get? Wasn't it like $28 million you were able to raise or something?
I think we raised between 25 and 30 million over that four-ish months for the festival.
And how much did you still have in accounts that you were able to say, oh, okay, it didn't work, I can pay it back?
We probably had a 4 or 5 million in the accounts, like that second, and it was all frozen, you know, within hours of the festival being canceled.
And how does that work? The government eventually decides who gets what?
I'm not sure. Initially, I don't know if the government froze it or if like the credit card processing companies and the banks saw the news, right? Mm-hmm. And like even like our Stripe account that customers were using to process payments. I think we had like $700,000 in payments that came in the day before. And Stripe's like, hold on, like they even froze that money right before we can get it. It's like unsure of where the money should go. I don't really know how everything's been distributed. I think that wasn't really clear to me. What I do know is that I pay restitution now. So every single month I have to give a check back to the government and that gets distributed equally to all the investors.
Okay, so I want to hear about that, but I want to hear about something else. Why were you the only one that got in trouble?
I was definitely the most responsible, like zero question. I think I was certainly the one that's like, okay, I'm going to start lying now to raise the money. I was the one responsible for raising the money. So I think that makes the most sense. Ironically, and I tell a lot of entrepreneurs this now that I meet, is that the majority of the investors knew I was lying to them and they invested despite that. And had I been honest, I think they would have given me more money and gave it to me quicker. So what I thought was a shortcut was actually harming me the entire way. So that was like a really interesting lesson learned.
Wow. Okay. So the FBI gets involved. You eventually get arrested. And kind of catch us up on that. Was there a trial? Did you, what happened?
I was arrested. I landed back in New York. The festival was taking place Thursday through Sunday for the weekend. We cancel it early Thursday morning. I get back to New York around midnight Sunday night into Monday morning. And then the FBI was there at like 5 a.m. So I was home for a handful of hours before they arrived.
But then you bailed out, right? Because I feel like we see some video of you hanging out in some amazing house. What happened there?
Out on bail. I was out on bail for a year. I had my bail revoked, which was insanely stupid, and was ultimately sentenced to 6 years.
But in your time that you were out, how were you still funding yourself? You were creating new ideas for things? Like, what was happening?
So I was really desperate to try to make money when I was out on bail. Everything I had like literally got frozen. I know I had very few things left at that point. And I was just like so desperate to pay this investor the dollar figure that he was requesting. And it was an unreasonable amount of money to make like in the situation or in any period of time, given like my current circumstances. So I kept trying to find ways to make money. I was, you know, still trying to book artists for little concerts. I was selling tickets for events that I previously had access to, but wasn't getting any more. And I was a mess. And I was spinning and spiraling and just trying to find a way to pay this guy or else I was going to go to jail, not realizing it was already too late and I was going to go to jail anyway.
Did you think you were going to go to jail?
I didn't think so initially. Really good question. I don't know. I knew what I did was wrong. And I guess I was just so convinced that this person kind of gave me this dollar figure that I had to pay this much money. I was just like tunnel vision where, okay, I got to get this guy $5 million, whatever the number was, right? Yeah. Like that's all I was focused on. And I kind of drowned out the rest of the problems, which was wrong.
Yeah. When they finally told you, first of all, did you have anyone on your side while you were out on bail? Did you have some good friends? Were your parents with you?
I definitely had friends and family. And I think I would tell everybody this, if you had told me in the peak of the times before anything went wrong, if a tragedy happened, who would have been there? I probably would have gotten every single person wrong. And that was like a really interesting experience. I think surprisingly, a lot of the people that were victims, according to the court, whether they were the bigger investors or whatever, they were almost the most understanding. And some of the people who actually gained the most, whether they were highly paid employees, whether they're people who somehow, you know, were getting money that was falling off the truck, if you will, along the way, they were the fastest to leave. So that was like a really kind of interesting, you know, way to look back and try to understand like the behavior and energy that I was putting out and like what I was attracting and why so much of that was wrong.
Before we move on from the documentary, there was a young guy and I'm going to blank on his name. He was like your director of events or something, the short guy with the glasses. Do you know who I'm talking about? Who seemed very focused on making everything happen. What was his name?
Grant. He's a beast. I haven't spoken to him, but he was like, I he's probably not a victim in the sense of the court. I think in my side, he was a young guy, extremely talented. I think the hate there is unwarranted. And I don't know if he's been able to bounce back from the public backlash that happened. And like, that's what kills me, because there is a 23-year-old kid who literally had the world by the balls and like he could have done whatever he wanted in his life. Right. And my mistakes led to a lot of backlash there that stunted his development and growth. So, you know, guys like that or girls like that, I feel really, really bad for.
Yeah. There was also a woman, if you'll recall, from the Bahamas, I guess, who felt like all her staff weren't paid. She ended up having to pay $50,000 out of her own savings and had no money. Do you know who I'm referring to?
I do. I'd never met her. And I think this is what really kills me. And I just don't really know how to respond to this. Like, I think so much of the real crime and even like the moral violations that might not have been criminal, they are glossed over. And I think that was my biggest issue with the documentaries is new crimes were invented when there were so many real ones that could have been focused on. I think just like the easiest way to respond to that is Bahamian employees, they don't like take net, you know, 180 days for their payment, right? They're paid that day or that week, or they're not showing up. So it's just not possible someone worked for 4 months without getting paid.
Got it. So you believe that they were paid?
Yes. I never met this woman. I was told later on what happened, but yeah, it's unfortunate that story is not true.
Yeah. Okay. So you were talking about restitution before. for people listening that don't understand it, what were you eventually charged with and what was the restitution? What did you have to give back?
So I was charged with wire fraud. And what that meant was the money raised from investors, I have to basically pay back. So it's pretty simple in theory, right? I owe whatever the investors invested back to them. And I have to pay, like, literally every single month, I have to go and give a check back to the court. And then that gets distributed to the investor group.
Wow. So what did the ultimate number end up at that you owed?
It was high 20 millions, 26, 27 million. And I think it depends on the hour. It's changed a couple of times. I'm not really sure.
And the restitution started after you got out of prison, or how does that work?
I think it's assigned right away, but it starts being collected after jail.
Got it. And then does it work that they take a certain percentage of what you're making to decide, or you have to give your whole check to the court? Like, how does that work?
It's a certain percentage. And if I were to earn a lump sum, they might take a little bit more. So it kind of goes up or down based on, like, what the income levels are.
Okay. So now I want to get into, let's talk about prison for a second. What was that like? You were there for 4 years out of six?
I served four. Worst part of prison that no one tells you is that the punishment is hardest on your innocent friends and family. I think once you're, like, physically going through something and you have real-time updates, it's doable. When someone loves you and cares about you and they have no visibility into what's going on, they mentally go to the worst possible place. So that's something I didn't know about jail. And for everybody I met in there, the people who cared about them had it worse than the people actually inside.
Wow, what an interesting answer, Billy. So, but what was a day in the life for you? Were you in a cell? Were you with a whole group of people in one big room?
I went to four or five different prisons. So I experienced it all from, you know, being locked in a cell to open dorm rooms and everything in between. Met a lot of really good friends, which I think people are also surprised by. And I think it's kind of goes to this concept where there are very few really bad people in the world. And maybe, like, 1 or 2% of the guys in jail were actually, like, psychopaths who need to stay there forever. The rest were desperate. And whether they sold drugs or got a gun or whatever the situation may have been, is the desperation pushed people to make bad decisions, right? Like, and I was arguably more guilty than most because I didn't need to do what I did at that point in my life. So that was kind of an eye-opening experience.
But on a daily basis, were you so depressed? Was there a time you wanted to just kill yourself? Did you think it would never end? Or were you able to sort of say, okay, I'm here, I'm going to be in the moment, and I'm not going to worry about 6 years from now or 4 years from now?
I wish I had the ability to live in the moment. I was 25, I believe, when I went. And at that time, I was, like, literally living by the day, trying to survive, whether it's survive with the business or survive on bail. So to hear, like, 6 years at that point in my life, it might as well have been decades. I think once you're in a really bad spot too, you start realizing just how bad things can go. And, like, I was, like, shortly into prison when my lawyer at the time told me, like, there is no rock bottom, it can always get worse. So it was kind of like this mentality where, like, things could always get worse. Mm-hmm. And once you kind of lose any ability to control your short-term destiny, your brain always starts thinking to, like, these worst case scenarios. So it's a pretty terrible existence where you're always worried about, like, what's the possible worst thing that can happen next.
Right. So in jail, I mean, you have a mind that works somewhat different than other people, I feel like. So were you kind of trying to create new things for when you got out? Were you thinking of things that you could do to have a purpose? I feel like you're the type of person that needs a purpose to really thrive.
The worst part for me outside of the hearing a family or a friend over the phone and just being, like, worthless was waking up every day and, like, literally having no ability to impact anything around you.
Yeah.
The prison system is designed to remove your creativity. If you're a bad person, you're a murderer, you're a rapist, like, you don't want that person to, like, be inspired, right? So everything is designed just to strip you down to being, like, robotic. And I was trying very hard to kind of fight against that and trying to keep, you know, creativity. I was writing a lot, doing a lot of meditation, but it's tough to be in an environment where they want to turn you into, like, a literal human robot, right? And you're trying with every ounce of your energy to not kind of fall into this institutionalized, you know, tunnel vision.
Right. When you finally heard you were getting out 2 years early, how did that phone call go?
I didn't believe it. And I think, like, going back to once you, prior to the failure of FIRE, I didn't really know the severity of consequences of my actions at that point in my life, right? I had guardrails up as a young man with a support of family, support of friends, like things that went bad never really went that bad until they were terrible.
Yeah.
Once I was told that I was being released soon, I think it was like 60 or 70 days before the actual release date. That was probably the worst 60 or 70 days, like physically and mentally, my entire life, where I'd wake up and go to bed every single night, just like knowing something was going to go wrong tomorrow.
Right.
Someone would show up and say it was a joke. Someone would say there's more charges. Someone would say like your family's no longer around. Like I was expecting there to be like that worst case scenario. Mm. And that was a really rough period. I had a good friend who was serving 25 years. And maybe a year or so after I left, he was called and told he was going home in 30 days early, like 10 or 15 years early in a sentence. And he died of a heart attack. And I think that becomes the hardest, like when there's finally some light at the end of the tunnel. And then you've been through so much hell and like so much bad experiences that you're just really worried about what could possibly happen next.
Yeah. You said you became friends with a lot of people. Do you still reach out to them? Do you call the prison ever?
I do. I actually went to visit a friend in prison twice over the past like month and a half. And that was my first time going back and first time going back as a visitor. I literally almost cried in the visiting room. It was fucking scary.
Cried because you were scared or cried because you were like, oh, I kind of miss the people here.
No, I wasn't crying for him. I wish I could say that. I was crying for my own fear. It's like, this is a really, really, really scary, scary place. And it's like hearing the doors clang and slam. And like, even though it was allowed to leave at the end of the visit, it was a traumatizing experience.
Right. So how long now have you been out?
Almost 4 years.
Okay. Four years. So why get back into things? Because I know that right when you got back, you went back into it and you kind of announced, I don't know if it was somewhat soon, but I remember seeing we're doing Fyre Festival too. Here we go again. This is what we're doing. Was it the motivation because you knew you had this restitution and how the hell were you going to do that? Or was it like, wait a minute, I want to show people that I learned from my bad experience and I'm going to make it right.
So the number one goal is I have this like reoccurring dream where I can go and shake the hands of every single person that I believe I wronged. And for them to recognize that I did what it took to pay it back. And that doesn't necessarily mean money. For some of them, it's certainly about the money. For others, it's not. It's the trust. It's showing them the intentions in the future. You know, everybody kind of has their own things they want to see. Mm-hmm. So I want to show people that I paid it back in every possible way. And I felt like the only way to do it was to go and try to make a big positive impact. And then two is I'm really scared of being completely powerless when I had no money and I was in prison and had nothing left. I'm a juicy target. Mm. And with no resources to protect myself, that was a really scary situation. Yeah. So understanding I probably had two paths to take, which is like literally do nothing, right? And then no one cares about you and you're fine. Like people aren't going to bother you. If you take a middle road, I'm a juicy target, but I don't have the resources or the connections or the ability to defend myself. And that's not going to end well. Or go big and try to pay people back and try to amass enough resources and value to others that I'm somewhat protected. So that's kind of how I viewed the world and decided to try to take that third path and make as much of an impact as possible.
I want to get into how you got people to trust you again to go down that path with you. But first, like literally when you got out of prison and you had nothing to your name, how do you, like, I know I've heard you say a couple of times, you talk to entrepreneurs, when people are starting from the bottom, like, how did you do that? Did you have to go live with in your parents' couch? How do you start that motivation to be like, okay, I'm going to go big, but here's how I got to do it.
So I had to go to a halfway house for a couple of months when I was released. It was like a mandated part of the release. My parents picked me up. They gave me $200 in 20s and like a Timberland wallet and like, go get them and an iPhone. So I was like, drove with them in the car from, I think I was in Detroit, Michigan to the halfway house in Brooklyn. I'm on the phone, just like, you know, trying to call everybody and anybody. The people that I picked thought would pick up, most of them didn't pick up. And an old friend, I'm not going to say who he was, but someone who I had not stayed in touch with when I was in prison. I called him. He picked up immediately. He's like, how can I help you? I said, the halfway house requires me to get a job for me to leave the halfway house. So he goes, all right, can you start right now? And like, he's like, write your own offer letter and come and show up. So got to the halfway house. I think I was out of the door an hour later and just basically hanging with him at his apartment in New York, and like he helped me get back on my feet. So
no way, that's a great friend. So were you guys trying to come up with ideas then, or he had an actual job for you to do working for him?
He's a super established guy, well known guy. I'm not going to say who he is, but he basically, you know, gave me a job and like that allowed me the freedom to get back to life. I could host meetings at his house. You know, I had everybody coming to see me, so kind of like set up base camp at his house, and it really let me get back on my feet.
And what was your original plan? Were you like, we've got to retry this. We've got to do Fyre 2.
I always knew I was going to do Fyre Festival 2 again. I was on probation and they had the ability to revoke your probation at any time for 3 years and basically send you back to jail for 3 years for any violation. That could be as simple as not picking up the phone or showing up late or doing a business they didn't approve of. So there's a little bit of a process of just like having to rebuild that trust before I went crazy with it. But the goal was to always make Fyre 2 happen.
Okay. And that story of getting out of prison and starting up your ideas and getting the trust back and getting the people to start working with you, was that a slow burn or were people like, yeah, man, let's go?
I think it took a one-on-one conversation with every single person, including immediate family. I'm sure you've experienced this in different ways, but when you're not there to defend yourself, even people who know you really well, if they keep hearing the stories about you, they start to question like their own beliefs, right? So I'd like physically see the switch where I'd be with somebody for 5 minutes and they'd be like, oh, okay, it's the same Billy, the same flaws, the same strengths, whatever that he was 10 years ago, right? Like not to the extreme that I was told by the news for the past 6 years.
Yeah.
So it took that like one-on-one touch point with every single person. And I just didn't anticipate any of that having to happen. So it was a slow burn to just like get back with every person in my life.
What do you think the flaws were that you figured out in yourself that you were like, listen, this is what I cannot do going forward. Otherwise, I'm going to end up either in jail again or with no friends or no money or whatever.
I think one of the biggest things, and like this is not like a moral issue, was just wanting to be around and wanting to be liked by a lot of people. And I think that led to just so many bad decisions, or it led to desperate positions where I had hundreds of employees that I didn't need because I liked the idea of being around a lot of people. I was moving really quickly and I think motivated a lot by like short-term, you know, goals or statuses or money. And that attracted other people who also shared those goals. Yeah. So I think I was kind of putting out this vibe and attracting people who also had that same energy. And that led to a lot of my bad decisions to try to maintain that lifestyle or maintain the size of that business or maintain that speed. So really just valuing a few small relationships and putting that first and saying like, fuck the rest of the world. I care about these five people. Mm. I think that that's probably been the best like mental switch for me.
Very smart. What's your relationship like with Ja Rule now?
There's no relationship. Okay. So yeah, I was, my lawyer said if I ever called him again at that point, they would stop representing me and I couldn't afford more lawyers at the time. So right. I had to stop calling.
Do you think that he helped or pushed you in the way that he wanted this cool friend that was creating these cool parties? I mean, do you think he had any responsibility in at least enabling your behavior?
Look, I was definitely driving the car, but all the passengers were bumping the music too, right? It was a fun ride. And we all knew that if we executed this, there would have been benefits for all of us, whether, you know, you were an employee, whether you were a partner, whether you were an investor,
sure.
We all kind of knew like what the potential was. And we were all, I think in some way all blinded by that, but I was the one who was ultimately signing off on the bad ideas.
Do you feel like any of them let you take the fall more than you should have had to by yourself?
Look, I think if it's most people naturally will do anything to avoid punishment. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this. I remember when the FBI, you know, picked me up when I was getting released on bail from the prison, they're like, one of the people who threw me into the bus really quickly, they're like, damn, that guy would have fucking sold his mom out in 30 seconds, like save his ass. I'm like it just like when they said that to me, it was just like really, really interesting how the people I was attracting and the energy I was attracting was like, how can we individually be as happy or as hedonistic or as successful as possible like immediately and not care about anybody else? So yeah, it's kind of like I had some really shitty behavior and I think it attracted some bad people too.
Yeah, I hear that. Are any of the people that you decided to have come work in Fyre Festival 2, were they any of the people that were working with you the first time around that believed in you enough again to come back for a second round?
Great questions. none of the three or four core people that are probably covered in the documentaries, right. but a lot of the behind the scenes people, whether they were advisors, mentors, I have a lot of friends in the Bahamas still, you know, so a lot of the same like support cast has been there, which is great.
Any of the investors?
I'm not allowed to raise money again, so I haven't raised money from any of the investors, but some of them have been like really supportive and you know, ways I didn't expect. And every 3 or 4 months I'll get a random, like, you know, text from someone saying XYZ is trying to reach you, you know, can I connect you guys? And so it's good to hear from them.
Got it. Okay. So we start to see that you get on social media and you're like, Fyre Festival 2, it's happening. Can you kind of walk us through what happened there? And did you announce it before you, you know, got too far along in the game of planning again this time? Because for people that are listening, you announced it and it ended up having to be canceled.
So we didn't really, I thought people would rush to a Fyre Festival 2, and I was probably listening and just like thinking a little bit too much, like ironically, right? If I went to the opposite direction where it was instead of like immediate action, it was like a lot of like planning without action. Mm-hmm. And we said, let's just do a test where we put 100 tickets on sale, where all the money went to like a escrow account. And we said, we're doing Fyre Festival 2. We don't know when, we don't know where, and we want to see what would happen. And the ticket sold out like really, really quickly. News went viral, probably could have sold thousands more than we did in the pre-sale. Mm-hmm. And that kicked off a process of literally scouring the world to find a venue for Fyre 2. We spoke with governments from 7 or 8 different countries. We spoke with production companies from all these countries. And we were ultimately pitched by Mexico in a group in Mexico to do Fyre Festival 2 in Mexico. So signed a deal. We went and announced the location, the dates and everything in Mexico. And after the media storm took place, where all these articles came out, the reporters were calling Mexico, the local government in Mexico issued a statement saying they never heard of Fyre or Fyre Festival.
Yeah. So what happened there?
It was like, whether the scammer got scammed is like kind of the ironic headline, but that's like that's a short version of it. And it was this really weird situation where we had a partner, we delivered what we said we were going to deliver. They did a public press conference with us, with their government. They gave permits, they gave statements, they issued all of the support for us. And as soon as the media came out and said they never heard of Fyre, it was this really weird situation. And I was immediately called by probation and they're like, why are you scamming again? Like, why does Mexico say this? And what saved me was on the official page, the Mexican government on their official Instagram account, like Gob Mexico, they had a carousel of like 20 pictures where they're like, we're so excited to announce Fyre Festival and support them. And they had the pictures of all their officials and my team, et cetera. And like 4 posts after that, they had an official statement saying we've never heard of Fyre Festival. So they're both up at exactly the same time. So
what does that mean? You think that because of the media scrutiny or the media coming in, somebody got cold feet and said, forget it? Or like, what?
Yes, and I've seen that in many ways over the years, right? It's like, it's really easy to think something is a great idea and fully support it. And you know, when things are like looking great, they'll back it. And then when the New York Times starts calling your family, asking you about other issues totally unrelated to us, right? You get scared and it's pretty easy to say, oh, we don't know Billy from Mexico, than to say that, you know, yeah, we're standing behind him.
Got it. So that's how it made it look like you had planned another one and then it had to be canceled.
Yeah. And the toughest part was I wasn't allowed to travel at this point. So we had a local production company that does big festivals in Mexico that we were relying on. But I think not being there in person also had a lot to do with it. It's much easier to like say, we don't know Billy, right? If Billy's associates are here, but Billy's not here, then there in person. And when we ultimately did Fyre 2 back in December, I was able to travel. I was on the ground. And yeah, I think that's why the outcome was much different.
Right. Okay. Got it. So now at some point you had to announce, did you have to give those tickets back or something? Like how did that?
Yeah, we refunded all the tickets for Fyre 2. And then we ended up inviting those people who pre-purchase those tickets, even though they were funded for free, to the festival we did finally in the Caribbean in December of last year.
Got it. And you called that Phoenix, I think?
We called it Phoenix. It was the Fyre vision. It was the entire Fyre concept. We changed the name. I was there in person.
How many people went to that?
It was 400 people for Phoenix. Honduras had been in the mix to host the original Fyre 2 from the beginning. They had been giving us great offers, great opportunities, great support. We said no to them to go in Mexico. When Mexico failed, they called Honduras back. And to their defense, everything they promised us, they stood up to it. The media called. They stood right by us. They said, we love this. We want here. And yeah, they really supported us and they helped make it happen.
So it was essentially your version of Fyre Festival 2, just under a different branding name and a smaller group.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. That's exciting. So now didn't you have to, didn't you sell the brand or the name of Fyre Festival?
We sold the name of Fyre. We did a number of different licensing deals. There is a Fyre Festival musical being made by one group. There's a Fyre music streaming service made by another group. And then we sold the festival name to a third group. So, a few different companies are building their own versions of it.
But explain that to me. No offense, but I don't understand that if you had Fyre Festival that didn't happen twice, how is there value in that? Like, did you make a lot of money and why would anyone try to, I mean, it's a great name and all, but you it's not like no one thinks of the stigma that goes along with it.
So the reason why I sold it was I was scared that even in Honduras, where they had proved everything they told us that they would stand up by that, I was scared that the media would still be so strong against Fyre that they would get cold feet at the end. So I felt like it was safest where it was called Phoenix. Like Billy plus Phoenix is more palatable than Billy plus Fyre. Now it's like my entire logic. I don't know after operating there if it would have been a problem. I think they still would have stood strong. But we sold it to avoid that issue and realized like the vision in the business is what I wanted to build. It wasn't necessarily the name.
Right.
And the companies that bought the name, Fyre, without Fyre happening, Fyre was the most talked about music festival in the world for 8 years. So I think there is a ton of upside for someone to come in and do it right. I do think that with me executing Phoenix, it might have taken away a little bit from that, but I do think there is still some opportunity for Fyre.
Did you get a lot of money for being able to sell it?
We got more money for the licensing deals that haven't been publicly released than the actual sale price. So we put the festival, Fyre Festival rights on eBay, and a company called LimeWire bought those.
Oh, wow.
And that was actually a smaller check size than we got for other licensing deals for the brand. So we didn't get that much.
Got it. All right. So, and how's it going with your restitution? Like every month, is it really hard to part with this huge chunk or are you living okay now? Like how does that work with your current life?
Yeah, some months good, some months bad. I do a lot of marketing consulting work. I do a lot of media and TV work. We just did our Phoenix Festival. We have been filming a documentary called Fyre 2 that covered the entire situation in Mexico from the days we thought that Mexico was our holy grail to the failure there, to literally moving to Honduras and figuring out renting an island, doing a festival in Honduras, to everything we've been doing recently. So that documentary has been helpful and do
and
a lot of like
that's something you own, right? That you can sell to a streaming network or whatever, as opposed to they just have you as a talking head.
I sold the rights. So okay. I maintain a minority share of it and we were paid basically for the rights to the documentary. But once it sells to a network, you know, there will hopefully be some additional revenue there.
Got it. So what are you doing now? I saw on your Instagram, you have gone back to some sort of technology company or something. What are you doing now?
So doing a lot of media, marketing and artist related work. So helping artists with promotion brand appearance deals. So building some kind of platforms back in the early Fyre space.
Yeah.
Help a lot of like venture capital backed startups get access to talent and do marketing deals. And then do a lot of different media promotional stuff myself as well. So excited for all that. I think the Fyre Festival musical, which I have like zero day-to-day role in, I think that has some potential. So yeah, just try to do as much as possible.
You said musical? Happen. Is that what you said?
Yeah. There's a Fyre Festival musical being made by a different group that did a licensing deal as well.
That's insane. I can't wait to see how that turns out. They're going to have like a dancing Billy and like... So
I hope not. I can't sing or dance, but they know that. But I think it's like... hopefully they let me mess it up somehow, at least in like the opening night, just so I can get them.
Right. Right. A couple more questions. So what do you think you finally got right out of all of this?
People. I think the team that did the Phoenix Festival, undertaking was similar in that we literally rented a little island in the Caribbean Ocean off Honduras that had nothing on it. And we built everything for the festival. So we kind of took that same crazy undertaking. Our team was 15 or 20 people instead of 700. The kind of core group there were people I had known for 13, 14 years pre-Fyre who weren't involved in Fyre, who, you know, had stuck by me.
Yeah.
So I think it was like working with a group of people that we really like loved each other in different ways where we weren't coming together just for the success of Phoenix. We were in it for the long term together and taking our time and finding a location that really supported us. So
who was the musician you had?
We had 14 artists at Phoenix. It was French Montana, Bobby Shmurda, Slim Jimmy from the group Ray Shremmerd, who was supposed to perform with the first Fyre Festival. So I thought that was fun. And then a dozen or so DJs.
Got it. Okay, fun. Do you think that you're going to redo this once a year? Do you think you'll have a country version or maybe like a yacht rock version? Those are more my speed.
So we will definitely do Phoenix at least annually on the same island in Honduras.
Cool.
We're working with a couple of other island countries now after the success of that who want different versions. Some want electronic versions, some want pop versions.
Got it.
So we'll be announcing this summer a couple other alternative versions of Phoenix in different Caribbean destinations.
I'm assuming that credibility of having Phoenix go well is going to help you in the future.
It really helped. And I think it showed, if nothing else, it showed the intentions were always there. And the intention wasn't to do a fake festival to scam money. The intention was to always do a festival. The way it went about it was wrong, but the end goal was always the same.
How much money do you still owe?
I owe a lot. I don't know what the number is. I pay every month based on what I earn, and some months are great, some months are slow. And yeah, so hopefully.
But are we still over $20 million that you still owe?
Yes. So if the restitution was like 7 or 8 million and I pay a percentage, I have not made like, 50 plus million in the past
right,
3 or 4 years.
Right, right. Okay. Just curious.
Yeah.
Do you think you've changed or do you think you've just gotten smarter through this whole thing?
Definitely changed. I think like from 24 to 34 as, what I was like an immature boy to hopefully closer to a man now, right? Mm-hmm. I think we all changed. I think 4 years in prison in your mid-20s certainly made me grow up. And those are kind of weird years, I think, to miss. And a lot of my friends who weren't involved or related to my businesses, just seeing them before I went to jail and after I went to jail, they've changed a lot too. So I think it's kind of like a critical, period of time in a young man's life. Growing up a lot. And I think it's just like really simple, just prioritizing smaller groups of people and smaller relationships and not trying to make people happy and realizing that by doing that, I'm often hurting people I care about to make someone I just met happy in the short term.
Sure. If I gave you one sentence to tell people who think you're a fraud, what would you say?
Takes care of people around him and never gives up. So I think that's kind of like definition I want to live and die by.
Good. Do you think you're misunderstood? And if so, what's the biggest misunderstanding about you?
Ooh, interesting. I don't know if I'm misunderstood. I think that I've just like made a lot of bad decisions in a short period of time and had a magnifying glass in those bad decisions. And how bad or where in the scale they fall, if the whole life is taken into account, is probably different than if you're just focused on 4 months of behavior.
Yeah. Last question. What's on your bucket list? Like you're a young kid. Do you want to get married? Do you want to have kids? Do you like, what do you want out of life?
Yes. And, I think all the family stuff I keep private, but I think that's all super important and coming soon, I think, in a lot of areas. Elsewhere, I think it's literally being able to just go up to every single person that I know I wronged and maybe not someone who the world even knows was wrong or knows is a victim, like somebody like a Grant who you just mentioned, who wasn't a victim on paper, but I definitely hurt his growth and career as a person, right? Like people like that, I want to be able to make it up to in some capacity. So putting myself in a position where I can kind of give back to those I hurt, I think yeah. That's kind of a really cool motivation.
In that line of questioning, the guy you were talking about a lot that came to you and said, you need to pay me back now, or you're going to be on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. Have you been able to apologize? Is your relationship repaired?
It's not. I think I've been a little petty there. I did apologize initially and rightfully so, went unanswered. And then, He asked me for something recently. I did not do it for him. So I think I'm being a little petty.
Got it. All right. Well, I got to tell you, Billy, I do wish you the best of luck. I feel like you're a fascinating guy. You're clearly very smart. And I hope you've learned the lessons that you needed to, but I will say going into this, I'm just someone like everyone else that has read about you, seen a lot about you, seen what happened. And it's hard not to obviously see that you're a very intelligent person, but sometimes people use that in the wrong ways. Sometimes people have very bad intentions, maybe along the way you did or didn't, but I like you actually now that I've spoken to you, and I do wish you the best of luck. And I hope it works out for you, and I hope you find happiness and success and completion in your life. I think you deserve it.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.